I just want to start by saying what a great pleasure it is to be invited to a festival of this sort in the company of my peers, other women poets, and what a kind of sense of reunion it gives me to be here with Mary and with Ruth. Ruth in particular is an old friend, and later today I guess I'm going to get to see Denise, and then Adrienne is coming, and tomorrow Carolyn, and I think what an incredible collection John Harrington has gathered for this. I told him earlier this year that I had been trying to write an Emily Dickinson poem. It's a kind of vengeful poem. Without naming names, there is an august critic whose book on American literature contains mention of exactly one female, and of course you know who that one is. A well-known male poet being asked to list the women poets, American poets, whose work he admires, could come up only with you-know-who. The facts in this poem, the biographical facts, are actual, and I'm calling it The Uses of Emily. Oh, how they rack their seasoned attention, the masculine critics, to find one woman worth mention, one woman who matches the list in their mind, and then they'll acclaim, they'll commend her. No one alive will do from the other gender, but Emily, there's always you, long, long and safely gone from here. Emily the good, wearing white and staying in, and little better understood now than you were then. While half Mount Holyoke College swooned, converting on the spot, what to make of your behavior, Emily the doomed, refusing Christ as your personal savior? No wonder Father snatched you out of algebra and astronomy and sat you down at home. Anyone could clearly see these intellectual wizardries were weakening the womb. Posthumously, you were disdained. The Atlantic Monthly's best reviewer said, Miss Dickinson's versicles are queer and quaint, and in emotional breasts have stirred a momentary burst of curiosity, but could predict that blear oblivion lingers in the immediate neighborhood. And what from this may we infer, except that fate is twisted? Poet you are, poet you were, and Emily, you've lasted. I'm going to be reading from The Long Approach, which is my new book, and taking a cue from Mary, I too would like to start with a spring poem. It's a poem that begins in the winter but ends on a happier note, and it's called Getting Through. I want to apologize for all the snow falling in this poem so early in the season, falling on the calendar of bad news. Already we have had snow lucid, snow surprising, snow bees and lamb's wool snow. Already snows of exaltation have covered some scars. Larks and the likes of paisleys went up. But lately the sky is letting down large print flakes of old age. Loving this poor place, wanting to stay on, we have endured an elegiac snow, whitest jade, good biographical snows, and public storms, official and profuse. Even if the world is ending, you can tell it's February by the architecture of the pastures. Snow falls on the pregnant mares, is followed by a thaw, and then refreezes, so that everywhere their hill upheaves into a glass mountain. The horses skid, stiff-legged, correct position, break through the crust, and stand around disconsolate, lipping wisps of hay. Animals are said to be soulless, unable to anticipate. No mail today, no newspapers, the phone's dead. Bombs and grenades, the newly disappeared, a kidnapped ear go unrecorded, but the foals flutter inside warm, wet bags that carry them 11 months in the dark. It seems they lie transversely, thick as logs. The outcome is well known. If there's an April, in the last frail snow of April, they will knock hard to be born. Now, this is a little bit self-indulgent. It's a poem called Grandchild. The setting is the outskirts of Geneva, Switzerland, right on the border with France. If you know that area, you know that just across the Douane lies Ferney-à-Voltaire, which was where Voltaire had his summer home, his secondary residence, and he had it there for a good reason, so that in case he was accused of heresy, he could just step across into Switzerland and not go to jail or far worse. Okay, there's nothing that I think needs to be explained having said that. It's just called Grandchild or Jan. All night the douanier in his sentry box at the end of the lane where France begins plays fox and hounds with little spurts of cars that sniff to a stop at the barrier and declare themselves. I stand at the window watching the ancient boundaries that flow between my daughter's life and mine dissolve like taffy, pulled until it melts in half without announcing any point of strain. And I am a young, unsure mother again, stiffly clutching the 12-limbed raw creature that broke from between my legs, that stew of bone and membrane, loosely sewn up in a fierce, scared, flailing other being. We blink, two strangers in a foreign kitchen. Now that you've drained your mother dry and will not sleep, I take you in my arms, brimful, 6 days old, little feared-for mouse. Last week, when you were still a fish in the interior, I dreamed you thus. The douanier brought you, curled up in his cap, buttoned and suited like him, authority's prop, a good Victorian child's myth. And in his other hand, a large, round cheese, ready to the point of runniness. At least there, says the dream, no mysteries. Toward dawn, I open my daughter's cupboard on a choice of calming teas, infusion, verbena, fennel, linden, chamomile, shift you on my shoulder and fill the kettle. Age has conferred on me a certain grace. You're a package I can rock and ease from wakefulness to sleep. This skill comes back like learning how to swim, comes warm and quick as first milk in the breast. I comfort you. Body to body, my monkey wit soaks through. Later, I wind the outside shutters up. You sleep mouse mild, topped with chamomile. Daylight slips past the douane. I rinse my cup. My daughter troubles sleep a little while longer. The just-milked cows across the way come down their hillside single file. And the dream, the left-hand gift of ripened brie, recurs, smelly, natural, and good, wanting only to be brought true in your own time, your childhood. Thank you. It occurred to me reading that poem that often we say the poet has one song and sings it over and over. Well, I think it's certainly true that poets build on their own obsessions. And as I was reading about that dream of the origins of the baby, I remembered this earlier poem. This is from Our Ground Time Here Will Be Brief, which I wrote as a poem for my mother on her 84th birthday. And I like to call this my sex misinformation poem. Birthday poem. I am born the last of four children. The doctor brings me, as promised, in his snap-jawed black leather satchel. He takes me out in sections, fastens limbs to torso, torso to neck stem, pries mama's navel open, and inserts me head first. Chin back, I swim upward, up the alimentary canal, bypassing mouth and nose holes, and knock at the top of her head to be let out, wherefore her little bald spot. Today my mother is 82, splendidly braceleted and wigged. She had to go 4 times to the well to get me. And I'm going to read one more mother-daughter poem. I wonder what's doing that. I think the room is bugged. This is called The Envelope. It is true, Martin Heidegger, as you have written, I fear to cease, even knowing that at the hour of my death, my daughters will absorb me, even knowing they will carry me about forever inside them, an arrested fetus, even as I carry the ghost of my mother under my navel, a nervy little androgynous person, a miracle folded in lotus position. Like those old pear-shaped Russian dolls that open at the middle to reveal another and another, down to the pea-sized irreducible minim, may we carry our mothers forth in our bellies. May we, borne onward by our daughters, ride in the envelope of almost infinity, that chain letter good for the next 25,000 days of their lives. Well, I feel emboldened by, it's always nice to go second. I think it's awful to have to go first. And now that Mary has mentioned that she did a USIA tour for the State Department, I feel emboldened to say that I did one too. My husband and I also were sent to four countries, the last of which in our case was Japan. And unfortunately, we had not been there more than 4 or 5 days when I came down with an unspecified tropical disease that was later diagnosed here in the States as dengue fever. But I spent 8 days in a hotel room in Kyoto trying to stop shaking enough to get on plane to come back to the States. And I was really grieved that this had happened in Kyoto, because I had so longed to go to Hiroshima. While I was alternately shivering and, well, you know how these fevers are, in the up and down part. In the in-betweens, I did a lot of reading, and a young woman from the American Embassy, a Japanese woman, gave me Ibusi's book, Black Rain. It's a novel about the bombing of Hiroshima. I really was afraid to read it. I thought it would be so scarifying to read, and yet it's an amazing book. You can buy it in paperback now in virtually any bookstore. It's a wonderful novel. It will hold your attention. You will be able to read it. I don't quite know how this poem came about. I think it was partly reading the novel, partly the fever dreams, partly my enormous and abiding affection for the ginkgo tree, because I grew up with one in the backyard, and Japan is full of them. After reading Ibusi's Black Rain, brought low in Kyoto, too sick with chills and fever to take the bullet train to Hiroshima, I am jolted out of this geography, pursued by Nazis, kidnapped, stranded when the dam bursts, my life always in someone else's hands. Room service brings me tea and aspirin. This week, the Holy Radish Festival, pure white daikons 1 foot long, grace all the city's shrines. Earlier, a celebration for the souls of insects farmers may have trampled on while bringing in the harvest. Now shall I repent? I kill to keep whatever pleases me. Last summer, to save the raspberries, I immolated hundreds of coppery Japanese beetles. In some respect, Ibusi tells me, radiation sickness is less terrible than cancer. The hair comes out in patches, teeth break off like matchsticks at the gum line, but the loss is painless. Burned skin itches, peels away in strips. Everywhere the black rain fell, it stains the flesh like a tattoo. But week later, when survivors must expel day by day in little pisses the membrane lining the bladder, pain becomes an extreme grammar. I understand we did this. I understand we may do this again before it is done to us, in case it is thought of to do to us. Just now, the homage that I could not pay the irradiated dead gives rise to a dream. In it, a festival to mourn the ritual maiming of the ginkgo, pollarding that lops all natural growth from the tumorous stump years of pruning create. I note that these faggots are burned. I observe that the smoke is swallowed with great ceremony. Thereupon, every severed shoot comes back, takes on a human form, fan-shaped, ancient, all-knowing, tattered like us. This means we are all to be rescued. Though we eat animals and wear their skins, though we crack mountains and insert rockets in them, this signifies we will burn and go up, we will be burned and come back. I wake naked, parched, my skin striped by sunlight. Under my window, a line of old ginkgos hunkers down. The new sprouts that break from their armless shoulders are the enemies of despair. Well, I think we need something a little light after that. This is called A New England Gardener Gets Personal. I need to ask about the time here. My watch has just failed me. How much time have I got? When did I start? I don't know. All right. This is A New England Gardener Gets Personal. Kale curls, laughs at cold rain, survives leaf-snapping hail, under snow stays green, comes crisp as a hand clasp to the bowl, then lies meekly down with lettuces and coal. Willy-nilly, after years of no peppers, a glut of them, perfect as Peter Piper's. Only pick-a-lily will get shot of them. None grow riper, none redden in this clime, but such sublime pectorals, such green hips, no Greek torso could be more nobly equipped. What ails you, cherry tomato? Why do you blossom and never bear? Is it acid rain you're prey to, or nicotine in the air? Are you determinate or not, wanting trellises, strings to cling to from the pot? What evil spell is this? Apple on a stalk, kohlrabi grows fronds in its ears, stands stiff as a bobby when the queen appears. Quoth she, my dears, eat this pale knob when small, or not at all. Winter's like money in the bank, that dull gargantuan, the Swede, yellow, thick, and faintly rank, is eaten by cattle and people in need. Carrot wants company in bed, presses to be held on either side by purslane, chickweed, and coarser grasses, meanwhile puts down deep, alone, its secret orange cone. I should really have explained about the Swede. In the northern states, that's what people call rutabagas. And probably in New Jersey, nobody eats a rutabaga anyway. Why should you? You have all that asparagus, right? This is a little father poem called Appetite. I eat these wild red raspberries, still warm from the sun and smelling faintly of jewelweed, in memory of my father, tucking the napkin under his chin and bending over an ironstone bowl of the bright drupelet awash in cream. My father, with the sigh of a man who has seen all and been redeemed, said time after time as he lifted his spoon, men kill for this. This is a sort of a little memory poem, World War II poem called Atlantic City, 1939. When I was young and returning from death's door, I served as chaperone, pale as waxwork, a holiday child under the bare lap robe in the back of my courtesy uncle's Cadillac, careening through a world gone wild. The Germans pushed into Poland. My mother sat up front, close pressed as bees to honey to Uncle Les, and wobbled the stick he shifted by. I hooped my leftover cough, but said no word, a bear asleep or dead. Later, in the boardwalk arcade, when a chirping photographer made me put my face in the hole with wings, they snuggled behind him, winked and smiled as he fussed and clicked the shutter spring, and there I was, corporeal, in the garb of the angel Gabriel, forever a captive child. Pink with ardor, not knowing why, I longed for one of them to die that slow September by the sea. He fell on the beach at Normandy. I never heard her say his name again without a flush of shame for my complicity. I'm going to close with the title poem from The Long Approach. And again, just before we came on, Mary told me, or I guess she, yes, I think it was just before we came on, she said that she had done the poet in residency at Bucknell University, something that I had also done. And I didn't ask her how difficult it was to get back from there to Provincetown, but I can tell you how difficult it was to get back from there to Warner, New Hampshire. And I traveled in this plane called a Metro Swearingen, which I had never heard of before. It looks like a flying cigar. But there's something about traveling and going home, the going out and the coming back. I think all of us who are, and I say this irreverently, but we are all in it together, those of us who are in co-biz, come to understand rather more about our lives through the act of travel and the suspension of getting from one place to another. And this is, I guess, a kind of a love poem to our farm. It also fills me with horror to think that when I was a child in grammar school, public school in Germantown, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Stephen Foster's songs were taught in music, period, and that we sang all of those racist songs, and I have a wind-up key in my back. I have them all by heart, and they have washed over into this poem, so you will recognize them. The Long Approach. In the eel-thin belly of the Metro Swearingen, banking in late afternoon over Boston Harbor, the island's 11 lily pads, my life loose as a frog, I try to decipher the meaning of hope rising up again, making music in me all the way from Scranton, where the slag heaps stand like sentries shot dead at their post. Hope rising up in my Saab hatchback, 100,000 honest miles on it, as I speed due north from LaBelle's cut-rate auto park to my spiny hillside farm in New Hampshire. March 21st. Snow still frosts the manure heap, and flurries lace the horse's ample rumps. But in here it's Stephen Foster coming back to me, unexpurgated, guileless, all by heart. 'Tis summer, the darkies are gay, we sang in Miss Dupree's fifth grade in a suburb that I fled long ago. Gone are my friends from the cotton fields away to an illusion that escaped me, a better land I know. Oh, the melancholia, as I too longed to depart. Now I belt out masses into cold, cold ground, and all the darkies are a-weepin' on Route I-93. But what I think of are the French pastel mornings daylit at five in my own hills in June, when I may leap up naked, happy, with no more premonition than the mother of the Pope had. How the same old pump of joy restarts for me going home. What I understand from travel is how luck hangs in the left-hand lane 15 miles over the limit, and no cop, no drunk, no ice flick, only the lightweight ghost of racist lyrics soaring from my throat in common time. Last week, leaving Orlando in a steep climb, my seatmate told me flying horses must be loaded facing the tail of the plane so they may brace themselves at takeoff. Otherwise, you run the risk they'll panic, pitch over backwards, smash their hock. Landing, said the groom, there is little we can do for them except pray for calm winds and ask the pilot to make a long approach. Oh, brace me, my groom, pray for calm winds, carry me back safely where the snow stands deep in March. I'm going home the old way, with a light hand on the reins, making the long approach.